Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, November 30th, 2017. A South Sudanese policy analyst says parts of the 2015 peace deal are going to be renegotiated if it's going to work.
You cannot say that you want to revitalize the peace agreement without renegotiating the agreement itself, because there are provisions that are obsolete, that do not make sense anymore. So those things would have to be renegotiated, removed, or restructured.
And the new report says gender-based violence is a big problem in South Sudan.
The greatest amount of violence actually occurred in the home, not outside the home. Some male family members, but mostly women's husbands or intimate partners. Intimate partner violence was as high as 73% in Rumbek.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Revitalization Forum to discuss the 2015 peace agreement is set underway in a few weeks, and a new report says the forum should address factors that led to the collapse of the original deal if there is ever going to be peace in South Sudan. The report's co-author from the SAD Institute says mediators must adopt a new approach that includes providing incentives to the parties. Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
IGAD heads of state called for the high-level revitalization forum in June to fully implement the 2015 peace agreement with the hope of restoring a permanent ceasefire and coming up with a realistic timeline for implementing the peace deal, which is to culminate in general elections. The Juba-based think tank's 10-page report says the call to revitalize the agreement suggests major parts of the deal had collapsed already and it's no longer relevant. It says creating security arrangements and transitional justice mechanisms may have negatively affected efforts to restore stability in the country. Policy analyst Abraham Awalich says IGAD must rework parts of the deal if it's going to convince the warring parties restore peace and stability in South Sudan.
You cannot say that you want to revitalize the peace agreement without renegotiating the agreement itself, because there are provisions that are obsolete and there are also provisions that do not make sense anymore. So those things would have to be renegotiated, removed, or restructured.
During the consultations with IGAD ministers in Juba recently, the Kiir administration rejected any renegotiation of the peace agreement. Awalich says a recent document IGAD circulated that offers a roadmap for the revitalization process does not mention renegotiation of the agreement. The Sud Institute report also says the deal was not citizen-based. Awalich says measures must be put in place to popularize the agreement among the people so they will embrace it.
So the national dialogue becomes very important here as an area where the people of South Sudan will have to search their souls on how to move their country forward in an environment of peace and ceasefire.
Awalich says the revitalization process should focus on security arrangements, power sharing, and transitional justice. He says these areas make up the heart of the deal.
So what is needed here is a clear political will on the side of the government to say, our interest here is to bring peace to our country, and we are willing to take every measure to make sure that there is peace and stability in the country. Without that, you are solely going to rely on the negotiation table, you will not achieve much.
That means the government is going to have to make a lot of sacrifices, says Awalich. He notes all parties to the agreement represent constituencies who must feel as though they are getting something out of the deal if it's going to be implemented successfully. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A new report entitled No Safe Place details gender-based violence in South Sudan. The report says the scale of violence against women and girls in South Sudan is so rampant. Ayen Bior reports from Washington.
Up to 65% of South Sudanese women interviewed for the report say they had experienced sexual or physical violence in their lifetime. Co-author Mary Ellsberg, director of George Washington University's Global Women's Institute, says that is double the global average and is among the highest levels of violence around the world.
We found also that the greatest amount of violence actually occurred in the home, not outside the home. And it was mostly some male family members, but mostly women's husbands or intimate partners. Intimate partner violence was as high as 73% in Rumbek and over 50% in all of the places we looked at.
The UK aid-funded study was released in partnership between the International Rescue Committee and the George Washington University's Global Women's Institute. Researchers spoke to 2,300 women through household surveys in Rumbek, Juba, and a protection of civilian site outside Juba. They spoke to an additional 500 people in qualitative interviews and an additional 500 men about their experience. Activist Valentino Achuk Deng, the founder of the Valentino Achuk Deng Foundation, believes men should lead the conversation on sexual violence against women and girls.
We must realize that this is something that has happened and is happening, and we must begin by accepting it and take up responsibilities. In that case, we could also rally the woman, because women also need to speak up and they need to be open and confident about protecting their rights and their place in the society.
Achuk adds that a national conversation about the widespread problem of sexual violence begins in the home, where parents can make sure their daughters are treated with the same level of equality as their brothers.
Our girls still continue to be the one to fetch water, to be the one to wash utensil, wash clothes, provide a lot of things in the house. From right there, you can see an inequality in how girls are assigned duties opposed to their male counterpart.
Jahan Deng is a board member of the South Sudanese Women's Empowerment Network. She blames the high levels of violence on decades of conflict dating back to the civil war in Sudan. Deng says for too long, generations of South Sudanese have lived in the shadows of war, which has torn apart communities and destroyed coping mechanisms.
So if we look into trying to treat the trauma and get some hopes for the people, some confidence, dismiss the POCs, help people to get back into their communities where they are well respected, where everybody has their own space to do what they can do to live in peace and in harmony.
Ellsberg is hopeful that the report can bring more attention to issues affecting women and girls.
And to open a dialogue about some issues such as child and forced marriage and bride price that are traditional practices in South Sudan that are not questioned very often, but that, according to our research, are highly connected to sexual assault and abductions and violence against women and girls, and that we would also need to address.
While women are the ones overwhelmingly affected by sexual violence, the report also found that 9% of men in Juba and 6% of men in Rumbek reported having experienced some type of sexual violence. Ayen Bior for VOA News, Washington.
12 South Sudanese young men and women are among 200 youth from East African countries meeting in Arusha to discuss challenges facing youth across East Africa. Ther Manyang is a young South Sudanese who was a panelist at the youth conference. Manyang says he's learning new techniques to help resolve conflict in South Sudan.
I came here for East Africa Youth Leadership Summit, which brought 200 participants from across six East African countries.
What are the youth discussing at the East Africa Conference?
The youth discuss a number of things. One, we're looking at the issue of integration for East Africa. If we could make East Africa integrated, youth will have opportunities to have a job opportunity. Also, we discuss other political issues and what is happening in South Sudan and Burundi.
You were on a panel this morning discussing issues to do with youth and conflict. What other experiences are you learning at this conference that you will take back to South Sudan?
Yes, I learned a lot. One, you should engage in so many activities. Two, there's a need for young people to engage with their political leaders in terms of dialogue, in terms of political atmosphere. And also, there's a need for us as the South Sudanese, regardless of your political affiliation, regardless of your tribe, regardless of your gender, there's a need for us, for young people, to come together to discussing the calamities are facing South Sudan currently. Another thing I learned, and they use in other East African countries, they have that kind of solidarity. If there's then a problem, the people should come on the table. There's no need to solve the problem in violence or the conflict.
With all these lessons that you have learned today from the conference in Arusha, do you see an opportunity for you to effect change in your country?
Yes, I'm already making my action plan. When I go back to Uganda, automatically already I work with the refugees and our communities. There's a need to engage the youth.
Why are you in Uganda? You should be in Juba. Why are you in Uganda?
I'm in Uganda because of the ongoing crisis. I feel like my security is not okay in Juba. For me, that's why I'm outside. I'm going to engage with the youth in the refugees camp. There's a need for me to engage directly. I need to bring them on board. We discuss the issue of concern about youth, for example, the unemployment.
And so you are saying that you also learned that it's very important for the youth to engage political leaders at the higher level in order to effect change in the country. If you are running away from the country because of your security, how are you going to engage the leaders in Juba when you want change?
It is a very good question. You know, we work through a network. I believe, one, the way I'm going to engage the leaders in Juba, there's a need for us to form a team within different African, East African countries. And then those youth, they will go to Juba and also to solve the problem. And also, I can use advocacy. I can push my agenda through East African leaders, through AU and United Nations Security Council.
How easy is it for young people in South Sudan to convince elders who are well-armed and they have like 500 or 600 following of soldiers who do not understand these concepts that you're bringing out? How easy is it for you to convince them?
I know it is quite telling, but there's a way. You know, when you tell a person the reality, you need to be humble. There's no need to just say, hey, this one is bad. You need to go down, you need to sit down, and you need to come with a solution and the reality is rather evident.
That's Terry Manyang. He works for a non-profit known as the International Youth for Africa. He's also a member of the Young South Sudanese Leaders Forum. Manyang was speaking with me from Arusha, Tanzania, earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, there are more than 2 million cases of malaria in South Sudan this year. Find out why when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What type of work do you enjoy?
I enjoy computing. Yeah, that's all. Because it gives me happiness every time that I do it.
Law is good. Law is good. I love the legal profession. Because it involves me and you. It's not like me alone.
I enjoy maybe working like in an office. Maybe my clients come to me like of that kind, not moving so much, and the kind of work I'm doing.
I don't work, but I play football. So that's my work. Only football and schooling. Yeah, because it's one of my career and I like it the most.
I am a nurse, so I like caring for older people because at that stage, they can't do anything. How they eat, taking care of themselves, it's a problem to them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The World Health Organization says there is a reduction in the number of malaria deaths in South Sudan. WHO says the disease still remains a big threat to many people in the country. Dimo Silva Aurelio has this report for VOA from Juba.
Cecilia Knight is taking care of her daughter who is being treated for malaria at the Turit Civil Hospital. She says she brought her daughter to the hospital 2 days ago. Knight says it began about 5 o'clock last evening when she started feeling the fever, then brought her daughter to the hospital but was only given one malaria injection. She says she hasn't seen much improvement, noting her daughter still has no appetite. Pamela Achan, a mother of two, says her son suffers from diarrhea. Speaking in Arabic, Achan says her children have been treated for malaria several times, even though they sleep under treated mosquito bed nets. She says her child vomits and his body is weak, so she brought him to the hospital where he was given medication. She says the hospital provides a free malaria test. The Global Malaria Report, the WHO, released yesterday shows that in 2016, there were an estimated 216 million cases of malaria in 91 countries, up from 211 million cases in 2015. There were 445,000 cases of malaria deaths in 2016 compared to 446,000 worldwide the previous year. Dr. Lincoln Charimari, WHO's malaria specialist in South Sudan, says more than 1,000 people have died from malaria in the country this year, underscoring that the disease still poses a major threat to life.
As of week ending the 19th of November 2017, we had reported 2.3 million malaria cases and 1,140 deaths. These malaria cases reported represent 60% of all consultations in healthcare facilities by the 19th of November.
Dr. Charimari says even though there is a small reduction in the numbers reported, the conflict makes it difficult for some health facilities to report on the malaria trend.
If you compare this with what happened in 2016, at the same time, in week 46 of 2016, which ended on the 20th of November, we had reported slightly more cases than we reported this year, 2.797 million cases of malaria in 2016, and 1,978 deaths. So in 2016, at this time of the year, we actually had more cases and deaths than we are having in 2017 at this time. But if you look at the general trends from about 2014, 2015, 2016, there's been a general upward trend in the numbers of cases and deaths of malaria in South Sudan.
While the Global Malaria Report indicates an overall decline in new malaria cases, since 2014 the trend has leveled off and even reversed in some regions. Africa continues to bear an estimated 90% of all malaria cases and deaths worldwide. 15 countries, all but one in sub-Saharan Africa, carry 80% of the global malaria burden. WHO cites insufficient funding at domestic and international levels, resulting in major gaps in coverage of insecticide-treated nets, medicine, and other life-saving tools. Dr. Charimari says the Global Fund, a major donor to the World Health Organization, has cut in half its funding for malaria support in South Sudan.
During the period 2015 to 2017, a total of about $74 million was provided by the Global Fund to South Sudan for the control of malaria. And for the coming period, 2018 to 2020, the Global Fund is going to provide about $45 million.
Dr. Charimari says that could greatly affect interventions on malaria control. In 2015, the World Health Organization, through the help of its partners, distributed treated mosquito bed nets to about 5 million people across the country to prevent the spread of malaria. $2.7 billion was invested in malaria control and elimination efforts globally in 2016. That is well below the 6.5 annual investment required by 2020 to meet the 2030 targets of the World Health Organization Global Malaria Strategy. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Still on health matters, tomorrow is World AIDS Day, a day for remembering people living with HIV/AIDS. In South Sudan, a group that is living with HIV says social stigma attached to the disease, combined with the country's worsening economic conditions, make life extremely difficult for people living with HIV/AIDS. And according to South Sudan's HIV/AIDS Commission, the country has the lowest coverage for HIV treatment in East Africa. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
Evelyn Letio, program coordinator at the National Empowerment for Positive Women United, says it is not an easy road for South Sudanese living with HIV/AIDS.
I have lived with the HIV for more than 25 years. We could even say more than 30, nobody knows, because I do not know when exactly we contracted the disease. But my late husband died in the late 80s, died of AIDS.
The 60-year-old Letio says the key to survival is acceptance.
I looked at all things positively, as stigma, discrimination, a lot of it was done to me, but the more I was stigmatized, the more I was discriminated upon, the more I got even stronger in declaring more about my status to people. And that empowered me so much. The more I speak out, the more free I become. The mind becomes so free, open, and then you see that the body becomes healthy.
Letio says, because of widespread ignorance about the disease in South Sudanese society, people living with HIV/AIDS get stigmatized by everyone, even family members.
My own relatives rejected me. My own mother stigmatized me. All the time she looks at me, she looks at a person who is already dead. She has to keep crying.
Letio says, international organizations such as the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis and Malaria, along with the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, provide antiretroviral treatment to people living with HIV/AIDS in South Sudan free of charge. But she says the harsh economic conditions caused by the ongoing conflict makes treatment alone ineffective.
There is no food with which they can take the medicine. The little that they had, or the little we managed with the partners, the money, the food, how to make them, the little businesses have all died because of the war, because of the insecurity.
The UN's World Food Program provides food to people living with HIV/AIDS, but Letio says because of the huge need for humanitarian assistance across the country, aid agencies like WFP are unable to meet the needs of all people infected by HIV.
In 2-3 months' time, you are given just 20 kilos of sorghum and then 1 cup of cowpeas. So if you have a family, tell me how long, how many days do you eat that?
On top of that, Letio says, people infected with the HIV virus like her are more vulnerable to diseases such as malaria and pneumonia, as well as other sexually transmitted diseases such as gonorrhea and hepatitis. Habib Dafa'alla Awongo, Director General of Program Coordination at the South Sudan HIV/AIDS Commission, says South Sudan has an average HIV/AIDS prevalence of 2.7%. That is more than 200,000 people in the country believed to be living with the disease, most of whom are between 15 and 49 years old. Of that number, Awongo says, only 23,000 receive antiretroviral treatment.
It shows a huge gap. And within the region, within the entire region, eastern southern African region, in terms of treatment coverage, South Sudan is the lowest.
Awongo says, The government has not been able to scale up HIV/AIDS treatment because of insecurity and political instability nationwide. He says the 2013 and 2016 crises have also created massive humanitarian needs, which has absorbed all the money coming in from donors. Awongo says the latest data indicates more South Sudanese women than men are infected by HIV/AIDS, but the numbers can be deceptive.
We see more women living positive, and that could be explained by different factors. One biggest being men tend to live in denial, most of the men. They don't want to come up openly.
The theme for this year's World AIDS Day is My Health, My Right, which focuses on the right to health and explores the challenges people around the world face in exercising their rights. The World Health Organization says 36.7 million people are living with HIV worldwide. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. The Revitalization Forum on the peace deal is scheduled to get underway in about 2 weeks, and a new report says the forum should address factors that led to the collapse of the original 2015 deal if there is to be peace in South Sudan. A co-author from the Sud Institute says mediators must provide new incentives to the warring parties. IGAD members called for the high-level revitalization forum last July in the hope of restoring a permanent ceasefire and coming up with a realistic timeline for implementing the peace agreement. The Sud Institute's 10-page report says the need to revitalize the deal shows that much of it had collapsed already. No Safe Place is the title of a new report that details the scale of violence against women and girls in South Sudan. It indicates that more than half of South Sudanese women and girls have been sexually abused. 65% of South Sudanese women interviewed for the report say they experienced some kind of sexual or physical violence in their lifetime. That's double the global average, according to co-author Mary Ellsberg, director of George Washington University's Global Women's Institute, and that is among the highest in the world. And finally, the World Health Organization says even though there is a reduction in the number of malaria cases in South Sudan, the disease remains a big threat to the country's public health system. The WHO's malaria specialist in South Sudan says 2.3 million malaria cases have been reported so far this year. That compares to 2.8 million reported at the same time last year. Cecilia Knight's daughter is being treated for malaria at the Tort Civil Hospital, and she says she brought her daughter to the hospital some 2 days ago, but since then has only been given one malaria injection for her daughter. The Global Malaria Report released yesterday shows that in 2016 there were an estimated 216 million cases of malaria in 91 countries, and that is up from 211 million cases in 2015. That's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song AIDS by Benjamin Laxin.
Siburas gowi yoti e e Auta dan kukuwis Was mauta kunkabarati Ayamde bele de makwis Ayamde dunya de mamot mun Fi amrat kuta
We have been listening to Benjamin Laxin with the song about HIV/AIDS. I'm John Tanz in Washington. Thanks for being here. We want to hear from you about our show. Drop us a line. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on the Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Kanita reis, wale tawzir.